Preston in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story. Story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations. Good afternoon. Thank you for joining me. I'm Al Cresta. And today, as you know, we're coming up on All Saints Day, and we're also coming up on the many Protestants call Reformation Day, more accurately, Reformation's Day, because there was no single thing called the Reformation. It was really a bunch of reforms, rebellions, clashes. We're going to talk about one of the great saints of that era, St. Thomas More, and we're going to, recently, Yale University Press published a startlingly big volume looking at his essential works. Well, Gerald Wegemer is going to be my guest to go over that. Also, we'll talk with Phil Campbell about his work, Heroes and Heretics of the Reformation. The church has a very nuanced approach to this because it realizes that in order to catch the horror of that period and the breakup of medieval Christendom and its unity, you've got to have a heart for unity, a desire for it. You also have to know it can only be sustained by divine grace. And then you've got to examine one's own conscience and, take the initiative in acknowledging one's own contribution to the disunity. In the Second Vatican Council, we learned in the Decree on Ecumenism that there's plenty of blame to go around here. At the same time, that doesn't set aside the truth or falsity of the doctrines that were being proposed. It just talks about our changing our attitudes. So we're going to talk about that today with Phil Campbell, and we'll also talk with Jerry Wegemer about St. Thomas More. But first, the headlines.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Thursday, October 29th. It's the Feast of Blessed Chiara Badano. Today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds. More information can be found at AveMariaFunds.com. Three people are dead after an attack at a Catholic church in Nice, France. A knife was involved and police shot the suspect accused of carrying out the attack. The suspect now hospitalized, but French President Emmanuel Macron is taking no chances. He's setting up to 7,000 troops to protect various sites, including churches and schools. The country's security alert status is now at the highest possible level. France has suffered numerous attacks in recent weeks, including a school teacher who was beheaded for displaying cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad. In a statement today, Vatican Cardinal Robert Sarah said the West better wake up to the threat of Islamism. An Illinois police officer involved in the fatal shooting of a black man in Waukegan last week turned his body camera off before he opened fire. 19-year-old Marcella Stinnett was killed in the October 20th shooting while his girlfriend, Tafara Williams, suffered serious injuries. Stinnett family attorney Antonio Romanucci discusses the body camera being turned off.
Body-worn cameras that were available for this very purpose, for what we desire and seek, accountability, transparency, the truth, were not turned on until after the shooting occurred.
Other police video of the incident released today shows a police pursuit of the suspect vehicle that eventually stops and then reverses towards officers before gunshots are heard. And a bipartisan group of senators are introducing a resolution declaring China's actions against its Uyghurs as genocide. It would also declare that China is violating the 1948 United Nations Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide and trigger an international response to China's actions. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. I'm just horrified by the terrorist attack in France. There's been a series of them in France, and this is becoming a problem. France has lost 200 people to these Islamist terrorist attacks just in the last few years. 2 weeks ago, there was the beheading of a French school teacher. Today, an Islamist shouting Allahu Akbar went ahead and attacked three people in Nice, the Notre Dame church there. And President Emmanuel Macron said from Nice that this is an Islamic terrorist attack. And at the same time, the French consular, French consulate in Jeddah was attacked. And France is being attacked, is what he said. Let me tell you a little bit about France's Emmanuel Macron, more than any other foreign leader that I've heard, has been direct about the problems of Islamism in a way that U.S. presidents haven't. They have not been, they simply do not understand, or they don't publicly communicate the ongoing threat, partially because we don't have people dying at the same rate that they have them dying in France. And so you can kind of sidestep this issue. But Cardinal Seurat, after this attack in France, went on record on Twitter saying that Islamism is a monstrous fanaticism which must be fought with force and determination. It will not stop its war. Unfortunately, we Africans know this all too well. The barbarians are always the enemies of peace. The West, today France, must understand this. Let us pray. It is ironic, isn't it, that the West, Europe, Western Europe, the United States, you know, likes to see itself as kind of the cutting edge of modernity, modern culture. And yet, the Catholic leaders who have been sharpest about this are the African leaders who understand what it's like to live with militant jihadism in their midst. We'll have more to say on this perhaps tomorrow. I'm not certain how much time. You know, we've got the election coming up. So we've got lots of things to talk about, but I do want to share Emmanuel Macron's speech with you because I think you'll see how different it is from what we've heard from American presidents. For a minute, though, let me just tell you a little bit about the three who were killed, the victims of today's terrorist attack in France. One of the big victims has been identified as the sacristan of Notre Dame Basilica in Nice, Vincent L., who was 55 years old, a father of two daughters. He'd been serving as sacristan of the Basilica for 10 years. He was a dedicated servant of the church. The former rector of the Basilica, Father Jean-Louis Giordano, told Vatican News that he first hired Vincent as sacristan of the Basilica about a decade ago. And he's not just a sacristan, he said. He helps a lot of priests. He was the handyman. The candles were always well lit. He was very discreet, very efficient, didn't speak much, acted with great humility and respect. He's the first person we thought of when we learned of the attack. He was an ordinary man, in the good sense of the word. Nice. Open. Again, this is not, they were not targeting militants. They're targeting just ordinary people. How about the elderly woman who's there, whose name I don't have? French reports said she'd just come to pray at the Basilica. Le Figaro reported that she was found dead with her throat cut, nearly beheaded, near the holy water font inside the Basilica. And then there was a third victim, whom French media are identifying as a mother in her 40s. She was attacked inside the church and went and tried to take refuge in a nearby cafe where she died from stab wounds. A witness heard her say, quote, "Tell my family that I love them," as she died. Yeah, there were others injured in the Basilica as well. The perpetrator, I'm not going to name him, the barbarian, 21 years old, had arrived from Tunisia on the Italian island, he came into Europe from Tunisia at the Italian island of Lampedusa in late September. I may have gotten that pronunciation wrong. He spent some weeks in virus quarantine, and then he went to France in early October. And he's in the hospital now with a gunshot wound. So he lived. He lived. No quick paradise for him. I'll leave it there. I could go on for hours on this. I just can't believe that we continue to see these things. I mean, the fellow Samuel Paty was beheaded just 2 weeks ago in France. Why? Because he was kind of celebrating free speech. And he was trying to, he showed the front page of Charlie Hebdo, the satirical magazine, which is, you know, no friend of any religious faith, I'll tell you that. But they had cartoons of the prophet. And he actually said to any Islamic kids who were there in class, he asked them, said they should leave. It's not intended to offend you. Which I think was, you know, look, it's a silly thing to do. If you've got Muslim students there, you have to understand how they're being educated. But he went ahead, and he was beheaded 2 weeks ago. 47-year-old history and geography teacher. And President Emmanuel Macron gave us words earlier in October, which I'm going to try to share with you soon, because I do think I'd like to compare them to what American presidents have said. This was far sharper, keener, more aware of the threat. And, of course, it's because they're living with 200 people dead in the last few years. We are not seeing those kind of numbers in the United States, thankfully. And speaking of thankfully, I'm very thankful to Archbishop George Lucas of Omaha, who decided to respond to a letter that was printed in the paper there by two professors from Creighton University, who tried to argue that Joe Biden is more pro-life than President Trump on the grounds that he's got better sense of health care, better sense of climate change. And the bishop said, look, quote, he published a letter here, and it went to the newspaper. It says this, among many other things. Catholic bishops hold that the threat of abortion remains a preeminent priority in this country because our laws and our courts so often fail to protect the basic right to life of a whole class of human persons, the unborn. It is currently legal to directly and intentionally take the life of an innocent human being in the womb. This is a gross injustice that results in the loss of 2,000 innocent lives each day in the United States. The status quo is not worthy. The status quo is not worthy of our nation. The right to life is not a Catholic value. It's a human right. This right is being violated in a final and personal way in communities across our country. John Paul II reminded us that this injustice is all the more serious because it is carried out in the very heart of and with the complicity of the family. The family, which by its nature is called to be the sanctuary of life. He goes on, he says, look, it's disingenuous to claim that expanded health care will necessarily address this injustice, since many falsely describe abortion as health care, and therefore a basic human right. And we have to be honest, too, in admitting that public officials who commit to expanding access to taxpayer-funded abortion cannot reasonably be expected to be allies in reducing the injustice of abortion. He makes many other statements. We'll have it posted for you in the Cresta Guest Archives, because I just think, again, strong statement from the Bishop of Omaha. And I got a listener letter, actually drew my attention to the statements of these two Creighton University professors. And what they've done in their letter is something which is tricky. I'm not saying that they're especially trying to be tricksters about it. But they've done something which has tricked many people. They've tried to redefine, for instance, climate change. I'll just stay with climate change. As opposition to climate change is pro-life. And, you know, look, when every policy or action that purports to improve the human condition can be called pro-life, the word loses its meaning. Tax policies can be called pro-life. Military decisions can be called pro-life as long as they defend humans. As the meaning grows wider and wider, it becomes less and less specific and less meaningful. It's like the word gentleman. Gentleman used to have specific definition. He talked about a person who owned land, came from a particular class, had a certain kind of breeding, courteous, virtuous. In time, the requirement of land and class disappeared, and gentleman came to mean those who were courteous and virtuous. Today, the meaning of gentleman has become so broad that it basically means any male you like and is thought nice. Or even worse, it means males who like to visit gentlemen's clubs to watch strippers. To be pro-life is very clear what it means. To be pro-life is to work to end direct, that's the key word, direct attacks on human life from conception to natural death. If every action that improves the human condition is pro-life, then pro-life has become meaningless. Basically, if everything is pro-life, nothing is. The second problem in the letters of these professors is their use of Cardinal Ratzinger's counsel. Forming Consciousness for Faithful Citizenship, too, discusses this in paragraphs, I think it's around 33, 34, 35. And it says that voters who oppose abortion may conscientiously support pro-choice candidates for proportionate reasons. Well, what are proportionate reasons? Where else are we seeing direct attacks on 2,000, 2,500 human beings a day? Now, if I knew that climate change would somehow climax on Saturday and millions of people would die, and I had a presidential candidate who was pro-choice, but in fact had the solution that could avoid Saturday's killing of 500,000 people, well, of course I'd be justified in voting for him. Only if the attack was direct, immediate. And there is no way that we have an activity which is directed against humanity, intentionally directed against humanity, that kills 2,000 or more a day. Yes, if I knew 500,000 people were going to die tomorrow, and this politician said he knew how to stop it, well, and I had moral certitude that he could, of course you'd be justified in it. But that isn't what we're facing. Every day, we have the shedding of blood, 2,000, 2,500 people a day. That's something we can do something about now.
The Catholic Church teaches that Jesus Christ is literally and wholly present, body and blood, soul and divinity, under the appearances of bread and wine. Feeding 5,000 from a boy's 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, as recorded in John chapter 6, is quite a miracle. Yet the next day, Jesus downplays it in verse 27. Do not work for the food that perishes, but for the food that endures for eternal life, which the Son of Man will give you. Likewise, God's provision of manna to the Israelites in the desert was also a great miracle, yet Jesus similarly downplays it in verse 49. Your ancestors ate the manna in the wilderness, but they died. This is the bread that comes down from heaven, so that one may eat of it and not die. Jesus is clearly stating that his Eucharist is greater than both of these amazing miracles, and the Catholic Church absolutely takes him at his word. Examining the truths of the Catholic faith, this is faithforensics.org.
Does the fourth commandment only order us to honor our father and our mother? According to the Catholic Catechism, it also obliges us to give honor and respect to all whom for our good God has vested with his authority. Respecting the fourth commandment, says the Catechism, brings its own reward, not only with spiritual fruits, but temporal benefits of peace and prosperity, whereas failure to observe the commandment brings harm to individuals and communities. We are reminded that marriage and the family is ordered to the good of the spouses and the procreation and education of children. The Catechism states a man and a woman united in marriage together with their children is what forms a family. God instituted the human family when he created man and woman and instructed them to increase and multiply. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
If you believe in the power of prayer, Ave Maria Radio invites you to look at their website to submit a prayer request at avemariaradio.net. Your prayer requests are shared with hundreds at the Dominican Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, the Servants of God's Love, the Monastery of the Blessed Sacrament Cloistered Nuns, the Family of Faith Apostolate, and the staff of Ave Maria Radio. Just go to avemariaradio.net and click on the Community tab to submit your prayer request today.
When I was outside of the church, there was always an unsettled feeling. There was always a feeling of something missing and something not complete. The deal clincher is we found our way to our parish, and we met just an incredible pastor. We learned things that we'd never been taught. Wouldn't be the person that I am without the church and without the sacraments, particularly the Eucharist. I can't live without it.
If you've been away from the Catholic Church, visit CatholicsComeHome.org.
This program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit St. Paul Street Evangelization. St. John Paul II stated that for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love, and the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation. So we know we're called, but how do we do it? St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
This Ave Maria program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit CMF Curo. Your search for affordable health care stops here. Since 2014, CMF Curo has provided Catholics with affordable health care sharing that goes beyond insurance. With programs that cost less than many COBRA and ACA-sponsored plans, CMF Curo is a Catholic health sharing experience that enables you to live fully alive while saving money. Call 1-833-GET-CURO to find affordable Catholic health care now. That's 1-833-GET-CURO.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Well, we're coming up upon the date which is commonly called Reformation Day, or more accurately, Reformation's Day. And oftentimes we have our polemical arguments, Protestant versus Catholic. All that is fine, but more importantly is the attitude behind it. Back in 1523, this is 2 years after Luther was excommunicated, Pope Adrian VI prayed this way: "We freely acknowledge that God has allowed this chastisement," that is the breakup of medieval Christendom, "to come upon his church because of the sins of men, and especially because of the sins of priests and prelates. We know well that for many years, much that must be regarded with horror has come to pass in this holy see, abuses in spiritual matters," and he goes on to point that out. It's important for us to get familiar with the attitudes and the characters of this period. Philip Campbell has written on it. He is author of Heroes and Heretics of the Reformation. Philip does quite a bit in the field of Christian education. He's editor of the complete works of St. Cyprian of Carthage. He has published a number of books available on his website dealing with ancient history and medieval history. He teaches high school history for homeschool connections, and is best known for his Story of Civilization series at Tan Books. We're looking, though, at Heroes and Heretics of the Reformation. And, Philip, good to have you with me.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here, Al.
Let's set the context for us. Was Christendom in need of revival, reform, renewal, reformation?
You know, it's an interesting question. It really depends on what aspect of Christian life you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
If you're looking at the church's theological life, if you're looking at the piety of the common people on the eve of the Reformation, all sources indicate that there was a vibrant theological life, there was a vibrant popular piety. So
that's true.
In that sense, I would say no. But if you look at where there are problems in the church, to be sure there was. There was problems with simony, the buying and selling of church offices. There was problems with admixture of political ambition and spiritual authority that were overlapping. And there was many calls for reform prior to the Reformation. There was new religious orders like the Theatines or certain national churches like in Spain. There was a whole reformation of the entire Spanish church in the late 1400s before, a generation before Luther. So definitely, there was things that need to be tightened up, especially in the era in the area of administration of the church, of clerical morals and things like that. So it's a yes and no answer.
Yeah. How, and so this tortured Augustinian monk, Martin Luther, how do you look at him today?
How do I personally look at him?
Obviously, we're going to be talking throughout this year and even in the next year with a lot of our Protestant friends. We're going to be talking about the Reformation.
Yeah.
What is an honest and constructive way to talk about Luther?
Yeah, I see Luther personally as a man whose personal scruples and struggles with dealing with the divine,
mm-hmm.
unfortunately got caught up in a lot of cross currents of things that were way bigger than him.
Right.
He has this very personal. You use the adjective torture. That's very accurate. He has this. He tends to confuse the inclination to sin, what we would call concupiscence, with sin itself.
Right.
And so obviously no man is without temptation, but he tends to view his temptations as sins. And, he both loves and respects and hates God simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very complex relationship he has with God. And the flashpoint for his objections to, the Catholic Church is the practice of indulgences, which kind of has to do with all these different things like purgatory and the authority of the church for binding and loosing and the treasury of merits and things like that. All the most, confusing Catholic doctrines for most people all come together in one place.
Yeah.
And that becomes the flashpoint. And then he gets caught up in, currents of nationalism, of Germans versus Italians, of nobility versus emperor, and all these bigger things than him. And all of a sudden, he almost becomes this icon for a movement that honestly he never intended to start.
Mm-hmm.
So I see him, but of course, once he does start it, he embraces the celebrity that comes with it.
Yep.
And, and then off we go into the Reformation. So I think, he deserves to be seen with some degree of sympathy, for what he got caught up in,
mm-hmm.
but not without any culpability, of course, because he definitely took every opportunity to fan the fires of the Reformation once it was started, burning the Pope's excommunication in public, his bombastic way of dealing with his opponents, and he really relished the celebrity that came with his status as kind of like the anti-hero of the age.
Mm-hmm. He very much was authoritarian, too, even with his mm-hmm. Colleagues. I mean, the movement, I don't know, you can call it a movement, I don't know what you call it, but what is commonly called the Reformation is out of his control within a few years, right?
Yeah, it is.
So he's not even able to maintain control over the currents that he thought he started.
Right, and there's no indication when he posts his 95 theses, he's asking for an academic debate.
Right.
With faculty at the University of Wittenberg, there's no indication that he meant to start a movement, much
right.
less a socio-political revolution that would bring down the existing order. But you're right, he becomes that figurehead, and within just a few years, it's out of his control.
Yeah.
And as he gets towards the end of his life, he gets increasingly bitter about this. But, it's very interesting that, he starts a revolution to restore what he thinks is the true gospel. And then when others come along, like Melanchthon or Thomas Munzer or John Calvin or other people, after him, he's kind of shocked that other people don't take the scriptures in the same sense that he took them.
Right.
He's shocked that anyone would revolt against the revolution, and he kind of sees Christendom as dissolving entirely.
Yeah.
But it's not because of anything he started. It's just because there's so many other evil men out there that won't see his wisdom,
Right.
Yeah, it spirals out of control really quickly.
Talk to me about Erasmus. There's public, there's at one time they considered themselves allies, I guess, but then there's a parting of the ways, and he and Erasmus find themselves on opposite sides. Who was Erasmus of Rotterdam?
Erasmus of Rotterdam was probably the most prominent representative of the Northern Humanist School. This was the, intellectual movement that was going on in Christendom on the eve of the Reformation.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of came with the Renaissance, and it valued, civic virtue, eloquence in writing and speech, and kind of a return to the study of ancient languages. Erasmus was noted for his publication of a New Testament in Greek. But Erasmus is interesting because coming a generation from before Luther, and then surviving into the Reformation era, he kind of straddles both sides of the fence.
Mm-hmm.
He's a ruthless critic of the church as a younger man. And the interesting thing is he and many of his contemporaries did not make the distinction between like a doctrine and a discipline that we would now. Like,
mm-hmm.
If we hear a story today about a corrupt cleric, you know, we say, well, that's not the church's teaching. That's just an individual man has committed sins or whatever. We understand the distinction. But it's interesting that for Erasmus and many of his contemporaries, they don't make that distinction. There's just one reality, the church. And if they see it as corrupt in some of its disciplines or the way its ministers live, then that kind of reflects on the church itself.
Right.
So you see in Erasmus's critique, he'll critique what we would call clerical abuses, but he'll also critique doctrines at the same time with no distinction between the two. So he kind of straddles the line between being a legitimate reformer wanting to end abuse and being like a pseudo-Protestant. Now, when the Reformation itself breaks out, Erasmus will think that it has gone too far. He never advocated breaking with Rome or repudiating the papacy or anything like that. And then Erasmus kind of take heat from both sides. The Catholics will say, you laid this egg. Luther hatched it, but you laid it with your with your criticisms of the church. And Erasmus would say, what Luther hatched was an entirely different species than what I laid. And then Luther would insult Erasmus crudely, you know, and bitterly,
mm-hmm.
for not being willing to go far enough. So it's kind of like, and maybe we can sympathize with the way our current society is right now, in a climate where the whole world is dividing into two camps, Erasmus had the uncomfortable position of trying to walk a middle line between the two. And, you know, while that might have worked when he was a young man, by the time he was old in the 1530s, you know, it was Protestants and Catholics.
Right.
And, you know, he was not comfortable in either side, although he later became more pious in his old age and kind of returned to be a more devoted son of the church before his death. But he's a real fascinating character because he kind of represents this older school that called for reform simultaneously while remaining within the institutional church. And simply as the Reformation unfolds, it's going to be harder to maintain that sort of position. You're either in or you're out.
Right, right. Now, this, I remember before I returned to the Catholic Church, one step along the way was realizing that what was called the Reformation was as much a political movement as it was a theological movement, probably more so. Let's introduce the emperor at this point, Charles V, and mm-hmm. what he had to do as a son of the church.
Well, Charles had, at the beginning of Charles' reign, he had probably the most enviable position of any European monarch. As heir to the throne of Spain, he had access to one of the most well-organized and wealthy kingdoms in Christendom and all the riches of the New World that at this time were just starting to flow in
mm-hmm.
from the conquest of Cortes and everything. And then he had, as a Habsburg, he was in control of the Netherlands and the Low Countries, and then also Holy Roman Emperor, so all of Germany, parts of Italy, going into Poland and Austria. So he had a massive kingdom. He was a young man, very intelligent and brilliant, very pious.
Mm-hmm.
And if anyone had a promising beginning that could have brought unity to Christendom, it was Charles.
Okay.
Unfortunately, a bunch of factors kind of coalesced against him to make sure that that never happened. Charles was not from he was Holy Roman Emperor, but he was not from Germany. When he came into Germany, there was a strong, organized resistance to him taking authority there. Many nobles wanted to kind of preserve their own, you know, independent little pieces of the pie.
Right. I'll tell you what, Philip, hold it there. We've got to take a break. We'll come back and pick it up from Charles V's inability to control those princes of Germany. My guest is Philip Campbell. Heroes and Heretics of the Reformation, the name of the book.
People ask how they can care for older family members who can't fully care for themselves. One answer is Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Visiting Angels assists adults nationwide with 600 locations to continue living at home and not have to move into a nursing home. Their caregivers provide assistance in hygiene, meals, and light housework. Services are provided up to 24 hours per day, and you can select your caregiver before service begins. More information, including franchise opportunities, is on the web at visitingangels.com.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at SolidarityHealthShare.org or at 844-313-4999.
The EWTN home video highlight for October is A Wolf in Sheep's Clothing 2, The Gender Agenda.
For two centuries, the ideologues of socialism or communism have used deceptive word jugglery to rebrand themselves as liberals or progressives.
Order your DVD at EWTNRC.com 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or call 1-800-854-6316.
Hi there, I'm Dr. Greg Popchak.
And I'm Lisa Popchak.
Research shows that when families openly live and share their faith together, they're more able to respond positively to the challenges they face every day.
So if you're looking for help in creating that joyful place where each member of your family experiences life as a gift from God, then you will want to check out our book, Discovering God Together, The Catholic Guide for Raising Faithful Kids.
You can find this book on the store page of AveMariaRadio.net.
Bishop Robert Barron.
Find out in any cultural situation, who's the Lord? There's somebody or some principle, some figure, some institution that has central importance in that culture. Whether it's king, whether it's the military, who knows what it is? Go up and down the centuries. What's the Lord? The declaration of the Lordship of Jesus will always be a challenge to whatever that reigning Lord happens to be. The Lord today is my personal freedom. I decide what my life is. I decide who I am. I decide everything from my gender to the ultimate meaning of my life. Now that personal freedom is so powerful that it's become the Lord. To evangelize the culture is therefore to challenge them and to say, no, no, it's not your own ego, not your own freedom that's Lord. Jesus determines the meaning of your life. Jesus is the center of your life, not your own freedom.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. Americans are voting. The two major parties represent very different ways of protecting religious liberty, the preborn, and selecting the judges who should interpret our laws. Much is at stake. Many years ago, I read a book called Shaping History Through Prayer and Fasting, and I learned that our chief opponents on earth are not human beings, but principalities and powers in the heavenly places. Naturally, our weapons of war must include prayer and fasting. Imagine it. God has granted American believers the dignity and opportunity of changing American history through supernatural means. So don't neglect the tools he's given us, and don't let the perfect become the enemy of the good. If you can't pray and fast every day, do so when you can. St. Catherine of Siena said, God can't use what we won't give him, but he won't despise even our humblest effort. So go out, pray, and vote. Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta with Philip Campbell. Philip is the author of Heroes and Heretics of the Reformation. We're kind of getting a thumbnail sketch of these very large figures. Talking about Charles V now, who was Holy Roman Emperor. He had the financial benefits coming in from Spain. But when he, unfortunately, and he was also a pious man, but when he begins to deal with Germany, he's not received because he's not from Germany. So what did he, how did he handle that?
Well, the nobles very quickly aligned with Luther and used him as kind of like the spearhead of, I guess what I would call a you know, a nationalist uprising against the emperor. Like when Charles V condemned Luther at the Diet of Worms, it was a German prince, Frederick of Saxony, that hid Luther, ensuring that he could not be apprehended. And it would be German princes and lesser nobles that lead the military, the political revolt against Charles. So it very quickly turns into a political revolt. And Charles will spend most of his life trying to put out fires all over his kingdom that stem from this. And it really gets bad for him because the German princes revolt, and then the French ally with them because the French don't want a strong empire. So now he's getting, you know, he's got the French to deal with, then the Turks attack him, and all,
right.
You know, just everything goes wrong for him, and he spends his entire reign, you know, going around Germany, essentially trying to put out these political fires. Eventually, he realizes that it's out of his control, and he will abdicate in the year 1555 and retire to a monastery to just prepare his soul for God. And there's an interesting legend about Charles V, which is that he spends his last years in a monastery trying to make a whole room full of clocks keep the exact same time. And we think that's a legend, but it kind of speaks to, you know, a man overwhelmed with too many different things going on that he can't get to line up. So,
right.
You know, he tries his best. He famously says when Luther confronts him, Charles says, a single monk goes against 1,000 years of Christian tradition. This must be wrong. So he's got a very, you know, good, you know, pious Catholic sense. But unfortunately, again, even this most powerful man in Christendom, he's unable to contain all these forces that are simply beyond him.
Did the papacy offer him support?
He had a conflicted relationship with the papacy.
Mm-hmm.
He lived through the pontificates of several popes, most notably Clement VII. Charles' army actually sacked Rome when he was in Italy in, 1527. Many of his soldiers were Lutherans. And they hadn't been paid, and there was a mutiny when they were near Rome, and the army of Charles sacked the city.
Wow.
Pope Clement was terrified of Charles, terrified of offending him. Later, when King Henry VIII would ask for an annulment from Catherine of Aragon, Clement, who in the past had granted such annulments even for situations like Henry's, he was terrified of offending the emperor because Catherine was his aunt. Was the emperor's aunt.
Yes.
And so it's kind of an interesting relationship. Obviously, as a Catholic, the popes and Charles had kind of a spiritual alignment. But also, as the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles came from a political tradition that for centuries had opposed the papacy, you know, politically in Italy. So it was just a complicated relationship, made more interesting by the dynastic ties of the time. So it's another kind of one of those lost opportunities where had these two sides, the popes and the emperor, been able to recognize immediately what was happening and come to a consensus on what to do about it, it might have been different.
Mm.
But, you know, there was a lot of history and things that had gone on that made that not possible.
When people think of the Protestant Reformation, they think of Luther, they think of Calvin, they think of Henry VIII in England. Often they forget that there was what has come to be called the Radical Reformation or the Anabaptists. Who were they, and who was Thomas Munzer?
Thomas Munzer was originally a Lutheran who broke from Luther because he thought that Luther was too mellow, too tame, not apocalyptic enough.
Mm-hmm.
Munzer was what we call a radical, a member of the Radical Reformation. This was a side of the Reformation that was kind of tinged with messianic apocalypticism.
Mm-hmm.
They believed that the disorders of the Reformation were signs of the impending coming of Christ, and they tried to organize society, you know, in such a way as to prepare for that coming. If they appeared today, we would call them cult leaders,
yes.
Probably.
Mm-hmm.
Munzer goes to the city Frankhausen in Germany, and he organizes the whole town kind of as a little theocratic dictatorship, and he makes this he organized the citizenry into this militia of the holy ones or something. I can't remember the exact name, but he gives them some weird apocalyptic name and organizes them as a militia, and he tells them that he's going to lead them out against the armies of the Holy Roman Empire, and God's going to destroy their enemies and all this. And, you know, of course they get let out and they're completely slaughtered by the Holy Roman Empire. And then you have other like Jan Bockelson and other characters up in Holland and the Low Countries, they take over a city and they proclaim communism, they institute polygamy, they force everyone to undergo rebaptism on pain of death, you know. So it's kind of like a militant theocratic apocalypticism, and all sides, Protestant, Catholic, they all kind of condemned these radicals. Luther and Calvin couldn't stand Anabaptists, and neither the Catholic Church didn't want them around either.
Yeah.
So they just kind of represented this radical, I'll say, the apocalyptic wing of the Reformation.
Now, let's.
Then they settled down and became the Amish.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, they settled down. Let's jump over to England and Scotland right now. You mentioned the divorce that Henry VIII wanted. He didn't get. He was once respected by the church. They had counted him as a defender of the faith for a book on the sacraments that he had written, or at least had his name appended to. How is it that Henry VIII, a lot of people are just stunned by this. How is it that somebody who apparently was aware of Catholic theology and thinking, how could he just manage to jettison the church and make himself a supreme leader of the church as well as of the state, knowing full well what he knew about Catholic teaching?
I don't know. That's the big question. That's like asking, how can someone leave the church when they know what they're receiving, you know? But the interesting thing is Henry VIII did not consider himself a Protestant. He absolutely did not.
That's right.
Later under his daughter Elizabeth, it will become more evident that Anglicanism is a Protestant movement.
Yes.
But Henry did not consider himself a Protestant. He detested Luther both before and after his split with Rome.
Mm-hmm.
Although through the influence of Anne Boleyn, he'd flirted with various forms of Protestantism. But he really considered that he was creating he didn't have any objections to any of the doctrines of the church, per se, except for the idea of papal sovereignty, which he didn't believe was he didn't believe it was of divine origin.
Right.
He thought it was kind of like when historians today will say, well, the Pope, his institution just developed through historical circumstance.
Right. Right.
You know, Henry kind of took that approach to it. So the easiest answer is to say Henry didn't perceive himself as breaking with the Catholic faith. He perceived himself as breaking from a man-made institution that he didn't think represented the authentic Catholic faith. And what's very interesting is due to all his conflicting religious laws, he eventually, of course, will drift more and more towards Protestantism as he gets older. But there's one time in England where he has it punishable by death to affirm transubstantiation and punishable by death to deny transubstantiation at the same time. So your only recourse is to not talk about it.
Not talk about it at all.
Right, because he thought the Lutheran doctrine was heresy, and he thought, under the influence of Cranmer, you know, he thought that he eventually came to believe that the Catholic view of transubstantiation was heretical as well. But he was burning at the same time that he was pillaging monasteries, you know, and having men like Thomas More executed, he was also burning Lutherans as heretics.
Mm-hmm.
So he simply didn't see himself as part of the Protestant movement, even though anyone looking at it in hindsight can obviously see that it was.
Now, his daughter Elizabeth ends up with what's called the Elizabethan Settlement. By that time, it is a Protestant group, right?
Mm-hmm, yep.
And within that group, you have the more high church, Anglo-Catholic sorts, and then you've also got Puritans. Mm-hmm. What is the conflict between them?
It's really a conflict over the Puritan sect in Anglicanism was basically English Calvinists. They'd adopted the views of John Calvin. And setting aside all John Calvin, we think of Calvin mainly with predestination, his theological views, but the most revolutionary thing about Calvinism in the day was that Calvinism advocated something called the Presbyterian model of church governance, which was basically no bishops. He didn't believe in bishops. He thought there should be no church authority higher than the parish level. So Puritanism, wherever it went, was revolutionary because it advocated abolishing the episcopacy in its entirety. Now, that I don't know if we truly recognize how radical it is, and we talk about this in the book. In many places, like in Germany, for example, and England, sometimes the episcopal sees are older than the secular government.
Mm-hmm.
Like the there's episcopal sees in Germany and France that predate the Kingdom of France, predate the unified Kingdom of England.
Right.
I mean, this is very ancient authority. So whereas if you want to envision Henry VIII and Elizabeth's state church are utilizing the episcopacy as kind of like leverage to exercise their authority over the Christian people, the Puritan movement wants to abolish the episcopacy in its entirety and just have a bunch of loosely organized congregations. So that's an attack to the degree that Elizabeth is using the episcopacy. That's an attack on her preferred model of government. And as long as the monarchs of England are not friendly to the Puritan model, the Puritans are always going to kind of be outsiders because of their refusal to participate in the Anglican government. And that goes into, you know, we in America know the story of, you know, why they came over here to get away from that sort of persecution in England. But it really is a conflict about how the church should be organized and governed.
Okay. Got about 45 seconds here. Pope St. Pius V, get us just a few seconds on him.
Great holy Dominican pope, responsible for implementing the Council of Trent and setting the stage for the Counter-Reformation. We always remember him for his prayers and helping at the Battle of Lepanto. Great, great saint and pope.
Well, Philip, thanks. We'll talk again. This was very helpful.
Thanks, Al.
Philip Campbell, author of Heroes and Heretics of the Reformation. Again, Heroes and Heretics of the Reformation. I'm Al Cresta.
Religious freedom and healthcare and the right to life are under the greatest attack in American history. Right now, Catholic healthcare and the pro-life movement hang in the balance. My name is Lewis Brown, Executive Director of the Christ Medicus Foundation, and we are leading a new movement to defend religious freedom and civil rights in healthcare and to build the culture of life. We need your help now more than ever. Join this movement. Go to religiousfreedomandhealthcare.org. That's religiousfreedomandhealthcare.org.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
John, chapter 8, verse 51. Jesus is in a discussion with some of the leaders of the Jews. They're talking about Abraham. Abraham lived 1,500 years before the time of Jesus. So in the course of the discussion, Jesus says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he will never see death." He says that often in the Gospels. "He who keeps my word or believes in me will never die." To which the Jews say, "Now we know you have a demon." And they say, "Abraham died, as did the prophets. All the patriarchs, the great men and women of the history of Israel. All these people died, and you say, if anyone keeps my word, he will never taste death? Are you greater than our father Abraham, who died? And the prophets, who died?" And Jesus says, "Your father Abraham rejoiced that he was to see my day. He saw it and was glad." To which the Jews say, "You are not yet 50 years old, and you've seen Abraham?" And Jesus answers, "Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am."
There's a lot of uncertainty in the world right now. Companies have temporarily stopped hiring, sporting events are held without fans, even your friends are being told to keep their social distance from you. However, at Ave Maria University, we ask you to consider advancing while the world around you recedes. Gaining an online master's degree in business administration or theology can propel you forward, distinguishing you from the competition when companies again start hiring. Apply now at avemaria.edu.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. I know that many Catholics have been beat up by fundamentalists and sometimes evangelical Protestants who did not know Catholic doctrine and tried to attack the Catholic faith. And there's been a very healthy response to that. Organizations like Catholic Answers, for instance, grew up to help correct that problem. And, you know, I've written a few books on apologetics myself. And so I want to make it clear that I do think the questions of truth and falsity regarding theology are important. But I also know that a good deal of what happened in the 16th century had very little to do with doctrine. It had a lot to do with politics. It had a lot to do with economics. It had a lot to do with pride. It had a lot to do with defensiveness. And one of the reasons I know this is because Pope Adrian VI, who was trying to avoid the Reformation's becoming institutionalized. So in 1523, he got together to make his voice known through his legate at the Nuremberg Reichstag. And this is, again, just 2 years after Martin Luther was excommunicated, 6 years after he posted his 95 Theses. And this is the way Pope Adrian went about it. He hid this prayer, and I want to read it again. "We freely acknowledge that God has allowed this chastisement to come upon his church. He saw this splitting as a judgment, a discipline. The Heavenly Father was saying, hey, get your act together. A chastisement to come upon his church because of the sins of men, and especially because of the sins of priests and prelates. We know well that for many years, much that must be regarded with horror has come to pass in the Holy See. Abuses in spiritual matters, transgressions against the commandments, indeed, that everything has been gravely perverted." End quote. So you can see the successor of St. Peter at that time, without in any way compromising the truth of our doctrine, also was trying to make sure we had a heart quick to reconcile. I'm Al Cresta.
This hour of Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
In the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations. Well, good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta, thanking you for being with me. And letting you know that we've got a great hour ahead of us here. One of the heroes of the Reformation era is St. Thomas More. He was one of the most brilliant men of his generation. He and his friend, Erasmus, were known as outstanding humanists. They were faithful Catholics, but they were committed to what was called the New Learning. And both of them made great contributions in this field. Erasmus, in the area of New Testament studies, gave us a translation of a Greek. Well, he put together a Greek New Testament. And of course, with All Saints Day coming upon us, it's a good time to think. And we also have Reformation Day, as the Protestants put it. It's good to look at Thomas More, because here's a man who went to his death trying to do all he could to maintain the unity of the faith without denying any aspect of the truth. He was not a compromiser, but he was a man who wanted to reconcile. He wanted Henry to repent, and he wasn't going out of his way to make life difficult for Henry. He was trying to make it easy for Henry without compromising the faith. We're going to learn about the side of Thomas More, though, this afternoon, his humanist side, his literary side. He was, again, as I said, a brilliant writer, and it's good for us to kind of flesh out the vision of the saint that we have. Look at Thomas More, the saint Thomas More, the writer. But first, we're going to get to today's headlines.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Thursday, October 29th. It's the Feast of Blessed Chiara Bondano. Today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds. More information can be found at AveMariaFunds.com. A Kentucky church is open again after being vandalized. St. Martin of Tours in Louisville was open for Mass Tuesday morning after its altar was vandalized Sunday night. At least $1,000 in damage was done to the church before the alleged vandal was arrested. Archbishop of Louisville, Joseph Kurtz, saying he's praying for, quote, the healing for the parish and for the offender. Dr. Anthony Fauci says we'll most likely know in December whether we have a safe and effective COVID-19 vaccine. He says the speed of the vaccine development doesn't compromise the safety or the scientific integrity of the process.
It is a reflection of the years and years of fundamental basic and clinical research that led to the development of the platform technologies that allowed us to make that very rapid switch from a sequence to a vaccine.
But he says the time frame is sped up further by financial investment in production of doses. He says Moderna and Pfizer will most likely have a vaccine first. Priority will be given to frontline workers, followed by essential workers, those with underlying conditions, and elderly people before it's available to the general public. A bipartisan group of senators are introducing a resolution declaring China's actions against its Uyghurs as genocide. It would also declare that China is violating the 1948 United Nations Convention on the Prevention and the Punishment of Crime of Genocide and trigger an international response to China's actions. And third quarter GDP is the highest ever. The figures out today reveal GDP grew at an annualized rate of 33.1%. Experts had forecast just a 30% growth for the quarter that ended last month. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. With All Saints Day coming up on us, and of course the anniversary of the various Protestant reformations, usually related to Martin Luther's nailing of his theses on the Wittenberg church door, it's a good time, a perfect time for us to look at the life and work of St. Thomas More. He's an extraordinary figure for that period, and a true hero of the faith, as well as a saint of the faith. He was a lawyer, assistant to King Henry. He fought the Reformation and ended up, of course, being martyred for his faith. But there's a lesser-known side, at least in church circles, and that's Thomas More, the brilliant writer, author of 20 books, hundreds of letters and poems. And we're going to get a better feel for who he is today. With me right now to talk about St. Thomas More and to really celebrate the publication of the Yale University Press Essential Works of Thomas More is Dr. Jerry Wegemer, professor of English at the University of Dallas, where he directs the Center for Thomas More Studies. He is co-editor of the Essential Works of Thomas More. And Professor Wegemer, great to talk with you. Thanks.
Great to be with you on your program, Al.
You may not remember this, but we actually talked probably 20 years ago now.
I remember well.
Okay. And I was thinking about that because I didn't realize you were engaged in such a remarkable research project. How have you been working on this all those years?
Well, 30 years, actually.
30 years? Wow.
Yes, my first course I taught on Thomas More was in 1990, and I had to Xerox most everything from old books, and it was very hard to read.
Yeah. Wow. Tell me about the size, the sheer size of this project.
Well, this new publication is 1,560 pages, and we have put in this More's 20 books, 106 of his letters, 300 of his poems, over 100 illustrations and artworks related to his life, as well as the prayers and spiritual guidebooks he wrote at various points of his life. We've also put in here the earliest biographical accounts. We commissioned new maps of the London of Thomas More and of his Chelsea estate. So we tried to get all the material in one book that you need to know the whole of More's life.
This is It's great. You mentioned that when you started this project, there was a real deficit of available works on Moore. Why is that? Catholics have this great esteem for him. Is he not well esteemed among intellectual historians?
Well, that's a very complex historical question, because we have the complete works of every other Renaissance author already in the 19th century. And when we pitched this book to Yale University Press, we explained that in order to quote Moore, we have to use the equivalent of the first folio of Shakespeare. Shakespeare's first folio was published 12 years after his death, and then every 15 years you had a new edition, better notes, up-to-date punctuation, spelling, a commentary tradition, and we haven't had that with Thomas Moore.
Huh.
It was done in the United States between 1958 and 1997 that we got the first critical edition in 23 books. But it was still unusable for the common reader, even for the graduate students.
Yeah. Why? I mean, he wasn't a member of a religious order, so right? I mean, so he didn't have a community that could contextualize him. What other reasons would he not have the kind of the proper interest? Did he? Excuse me. Is it because Western thought was in many ways influenced by Protestantism?
Well, it's not an accident that he's been embraced in the United States very strongly, because when you read closely his early works, he clearly has the understanding that human beings are meant to be self-governing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He introduces in those early works the whole vocabulary of the ancient Roman Republic. He has the understanding of human beings who are free. He never uses the word subjects, for instance, in his literary works.
Hmm.
He calls the English the people of England. He calls them citizens of England.
Interesting.
And he has a lot of poems about the dangers of monarchy in terms of acquiring too much power, the propensity to pride, and the corrupting effect of wealth that's not really been earned.
So he is, that would make him, within Anglican letters, not an especially respected figure for those first few centuries?
Well, we do have a history of Socrates being killed in Athens
right.
for talking too much about virtue, and we had Cicero, who was murdered in Rome, and his hands and head nailed to the rostrum, from which he spoke about republican self-government in a time where benevolent dictatorship took over Rome. So this is a complex historical and political, and certainly in terms of Moore's Catholic faith, his understanding of a self-governing people has deep roots in Catholic theology.
Mm-hmm. You teach a course called Thomas Moore, Renaissance and Reformation, two categories which are, we use to kind of get a handle on particular period of time in Western thought. What was Moore's understanding of Renaissance and Reformation?
Now, you couldn't have one without the other.
Okay.
That is, both Moore and the whole group of European Renaissance figures at that time, humanists they were called, saw that there needed to be a return to the sources. So, birth. And it was the rebirth to go back to the Bible. It was to go back to the church fathers.
Mm-hmm.
Moore, after law school, learned Greek so he could read the Greek and Latin church fathers and the Greek classical thinkers in the original text so he could have a direct access to them. And he clearly understood that we all need reformation all the time.
Yeah.
individuals and corporate. So he and the European Renaissance humanist circle that he was part of were trying to go back to better education, understanding that laws are meant to be a help to society, and that the church-state distinction should be honored. So on Moore's tomb in Canterbury is the first quote from the first, from the first phrase of the Magna Carta, that the English church shall be free.
Hmm.
Moore and these European humanists understood clearly that the church should not be involved in politics,
mm-hmm.
and politics should not be controlling the church.
Yeah. Of course, the great irony here is that he dies as a result of King Henry, who tries to embody both the supreme head of the church and supreme head of the state. It's really almost an archetypical battle that we have here. King Henry becomes what Thomas More feared. Is that right?
He does. And this is why we wanted to put all of his writings in one book. One of his earliest poems is a poem written to Henry at 17 years old when he becomes king. And Henry's ambition at 17 was to be an imperial ruler, invading France, and, of course, having control of Ireland. And in this poem, Moore warns Henry about being an Achilles, dragging the body of Hector behind his chariot.
Wow.
And he warns him explicitly that too much power corrupts even the best of men. Now, Moore, this is a part of the drama of Moore's life and part of the great interest of Moore's life, that Moore does represent truly a life in full, a person who has a balance between family, friends, professional, civic, and the spiritual dimensions of life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he is a loyal friend to Henry to the end, and he tries to appeal to the best in Henry, even on the scaffold. And again, this is where people need to look at the whole of his life,
yeah.
at every phase, and see what he is actually, what he actually did and said.
What was his age? Was he older or younger than Henry? Older?
He was older.
Yeah.
Yes.
How much older than Henry?
Roughly 15 years.
Okay. So when Henry becomes, at 17 then, Moore's 32 when he writes to Henry. So Moore had, he saw himself then in relationship to this young monarch. He saw himself as someone that could help Henry, navigate the responsibilities and the temptations of imperial life, monarchical life.
That's right. And he's keenly aware, both through the Bible and through classical thought, the danger of tyranny.
Okay.
One, for instance, surprise that Steve Smith and I, Steve is the co-editor of this. He's mm-hmm. been my partner for 20 years in work. His first published essay was an essay about tyranny and what do you possibly do when you are in a country, a republic that's been taken over by a tyrant.
Good heavens.
Now, answer is most instructive that he gives. That you have to be a tested leader with extraordinary prudence and courage, like Ulysses. Ulysses, of course, Odysseus, the wiliest and
right.
most famous figure of the classical world. And you have to understand what are the possibilities and what's good for the whole. And it may mean you'd have to suffer through a tyrant for a long time until you get the right opportunity to change things.
Wow. Wow. Looking at the life of St. Thomas More, it's not hard to see the fingers of Providence here. My guest is Professor Gerard Wegemer. He and Stephen Smith have edited The Essential Works of Thomas More, published by Yale University Press. We'll be right back.
Why does the Catholic Church obligate its members to attend Mass on Sundays? For Christians, Sunday, the first day of the week, or the eighth day, replaces the seventh day, the Sabbath, as the day to reserve for worshiping God. The Sabbath represents the completion of the first creation. When Jesus Christ arose from the dead on Sunday, he inaugurated the new creation. Thus, Sunday became the Lord's Day and is now the foremost holy day of obligation in the universal church, as we are told in the Catholic Catechism. We are bound to attend Mass under pain of grave sin unless there is a serious reason for not doing so. Sundays are also called to be a day of rest. Christians are bound to abstain from work which impedes worshiping God and the joy of the Lord's Day. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
I'm Dr. Stan Williams, and this is the logic of Catholicism. Solanus Casey said, "Appreciation is as necessary for social order and harmony as are the laws of gravity for the physical world." Critics of the Church often boast, "What good is the Church anyway? Science can tell us everything we need to know." Okay, fine. Ignore the Church's moral teachings. Why is it then that after centuries of study, social and biological scientists tell us that among observant Christians, there is less crime, disease, and suicide, and higher levels of charity, service, and happiness? The reason is that for millennia, through God's revelation, Catholic precepts have provided shortcuts to understanding what is good, true, and beautiful. Today, share with your friends your appreciation for the Church's shortcuts to the good life. And that's the logic of Catholicism. Explore more at AveMariaRadio.net. Under Resources, look for me, Dr. Stan Williams.
If you believe in the power of prayer, Ave Maria Radio invites you to look at their website to submit a prayer request at AveMariaRadio.net. Your prayer requests are shared with hundreds at the Dominican Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, the Servants of God's Love, the Monastery of the Blessed Sacrament Cloistered Nuns, the Family of Faith Apostolate, and the staff of Ave Maria Radio. Just go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the Community tab to submit your prayer request today.
Did you know you were kicking in your mommy's tummy before you were born?
We were?
Yep, I just learned at school that babies move and kick before they're even born.
No wonder we're so good at soccer.
Hello, I'm Marian Kuharski, the director of Pro-Life Across America. We know that conversations about right to life have become very heated, even angry. We stay away from that political fray. We're non-political and totally educational. We don't scream or scold. Instead, we help people working through unplanned pregnancies know their options. We're here to help both mom and the baby, and we rely on people like you to help with our mission. Please call 1-800-366-7773. Check us out on Facebook, YouTube, or at ProLifeAcrossAmerica.org.
A baby's heart is beating 18 days from conception.
Pro Life Across America, the billboard people.
Religious freedom and health care and the right to life are under the greatest attack in American history. Right now, Catholic health care and the pro-life movement hang in the balance. My name is Lewis Brown, Executive Director of the Christ Medicus Foundation, and we are leading a new movement to defend religious freedom and civil rights in healthcare, and to build the culture of life. We need your help now more than ever. Join this movement. Go to religiousfreedomandhealthcare.org. That's religiousfreedomandhealthcare.org.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me is Professor Gerard Wegemer. He is co-editor of The Essential Works of Thomas More. There's no volume like this. 20 of Moore's books, 106 of his letters, 300 of his poems, a reconstruction of his trial, over 100 illustrations, artwork related to his life and writings. There's prayers and spiritual guidebooks, 4 Socratic dialogues. It's easy to say there's nothing comparable that is out there. It took over 30 years to bring this work together, and we're talking about St. Thomas More, why he is such a revered figure, and also why He was a major Renaissance figure who did not have a critical edition of his works completed by 19th century and 20th century scholarship. When Moore writes early on about tyranny, this is his first essay?
Yes.
Go ahead, please.
It's a playful exercise, playful on the surface, but quite serious in the choice of the topic, that he includes with his first book of translations he does with Erasmus. And he challenges Erasmus to a Greek translating contest to do this book. And as part of the contest, he says, let's both write a declamation, a speech, responding to the situation of a tyrant being in a city. And they're fascinating to read and compare. Now, I should also point out to your listeners, there's also a supporting website for this book that's open to anyone. It's theessentialmoore.org.
Good.
And it has study guides for Moore's works and recreations of many of the maps and also bibliographies for the critical studies of Moore's works.
Very good. Essentialmoore.org.
Correct.
We're talking about his first essay that he writes, and again, in competition with Erasmus. His most influential book was The History of King Richard III. That wasn't even published in his lifetime, though.
That's correct. It was too revealing, and Moore decided to take a more playful, thought-provoking approach in creating the utopia.
Mm.
So he writes two versions of the history of Richard III, and this is, of course, what Shakespeare studied very closely early in his life. Shakespeare's first four plays are based on that history and expand the issues on that. But it is the perennial problem of tyranny. Now, every corporation faces this. Every political situation faces too much power in someone's hands where there's no possibility of collaborative thinking. Now, people also rarely know that Thomas Moore was the first person to write a speech defending free speech for Parliament. When he was the Speaker of the House, chosen as the Speaker of the House in 1523, his first act was to petition the king for the right for everyone in that House to speak their mind clearly in order to have the kind of debate needed to bring out all the aspects of the issue. This just shows how deeply and how carefully Moore prepared himself and thought about his profession. Now, one other important dimension, I believe, of understanding Moore's place is why St. John Paul II made him the patron of statesmen in the year 2000. Now, the technical term that St. John Paul used was the patron of gubernatores. Gubernator means pilot, and political leader is the captain of a ship, and ships always face storms. And so how do you actually prepare yourself so you can save your ship and prevent mutinies and all the complex issues that any captain has to do? And this is where Moore's life is very instructive, how he prepared himself. He didn't join Henry's court until he was 40 and until he tested himself if he had what it took to actually be a captain of that kind of a ship.
Wow.
And in between law school and accepting a position in the King's Court, he studied all of the classics, Greek, Latin, Hebrew, biblical, British classics, about the issue of rulership, justice. And that was a morning study. He started every day with prayer and study throughout his life.
He has a rich inner life. He has a beautifully balanced external life. Did he see his, I guess, given he starts out writing this essay on tyranny, given his testing of himself before he joins Henry's court, and then, of course, his death and martyrdom, did he see his life as a coherent narrative. God was unfolding. How did he see? Because he focuses in on the passion of Christ, of course, right at the end of his life. Does he see himself as living out some kind of experiment in living?
He certainly has an unshakable trust in providence, but he also realizes that life unfolds in the most unexpected ways. And this is another reason that his life is particularly instructive for anyone looking for a very active life in a changing culture. Moore does live through one of the most tumultuous periods in history. And it's remarkable that his family remembers seeing him angry only twice.
This is not
just temperament.
Yeah.
He trains himself. And he also, again, studies what it is that the circumstances are requiring of him. And here again, one of the surprises, one of the discoveries in putting together all of these works together, in that same work, and then throughout his works until The Tower, Moore refers to or alludes to that biblical statement that God loves a cheerful giver. That cheer, good cheer, is part of faith, and it's part of charity.
Interesting.
Now, he has a naturally good sense of humor, but we all know that humor could be used as a weapon. And he has a statement that humor should be the sauce and not the meat of a conversation.
Very good.
And here again, you see the depth of his reflection, but also the strength of his self-discipline in seeing the work as it unfolds and responding to it in ways that he normally wouldn't. So he knows it's dangerous to join the king's court.
Right.
He's the highest paid lawyer in London. He's writing books that are classics throughout Europe, and he's asked to join the king's court. This is not according to his natural bent or his deepest interests, but he does see a certain duty.
You mentioned that he's the first to use the English word integrity.
That's right. Now, of course, the word exists in Latin, but he uses it at key points, and he uses it quite often in Latin as well, in his Latin works. But to live a life of integrity does require a great deal of reflection and preparation, because integrity means consistency of word, thought, and deed. And in some ways, the other element that Moore points out very early in his works is that a person has to be able and has to work on developing a calm of soul so that the reason can actually guide you.
Okay.
This is something he cultivated all his life.
Yeah.
And he's fully aware of fallen human nature and of his own fallen human nature. He, for example, knows himself to be a very fearful man by temperament. And he sees this fear so operative in his own life, and you can see this in the letters that are in this collection, that he says, I scandalized myself by how fearful I was before I took the plunge and refused and was imprisoned.
Yeah.
And in prison, he to strengthen his own resistance to his own fear. Again, this is something, in a sense, everyone needs. I mean, everyone experiences themselves,
yes.
But it's also very helpful to know that even in someone as gifted as Thomas Moore, it was not easy.
Right.
It was the struggle, the drama of his life.
And how does he strengthen himself when he's in prison there? How does he, confront the fears that he had, and now he's in the situation he may well have feared, But how does he strengthen himself in that?
He writes two of his most important and extraordinarily artful works. And one of them is called The Dialogue of Comfort Against Tribulation. Comfort comes from the Latin word comforte, with courage. Mm-hmm. And tribulation is, a tribulum is a threshing sledge. So this is not ordinary suffering. This is suffering by being hit by a threshing sledge. Mm-hmm. And it's the dialogue between a young man who's petrified with fear and an old man who's gone through trials all his life and is on his deathbed. And through 3 days of conversation, the old fellow helps the young fellow acquire the strategy and the perspective needed to face his own fears. And then the second work, the very last work, written in the, hastily in the last weeks of his life, once he realized that he would be executed, is The Sadness of Christ. And this is a line-by-line commentary when Christ himself experiences his whole body rebelling against his conscience in facing the suffering that is his path. That he sweats blood, he is prone on the ground, and more reflects on these phrase by phrase in this whole scene. These are extraordinary works.
Wow.
But they're also written for others, but they're also written for himself.
Professor Wegemer, hold there. Can you stay with me another segment?
Sure.
Very good. My guest is Professor Gerard Wegemer. He and Stephen Smith have cooperated and co-edited The Essential Works of Thomas More. It's a real landmark in the history of ideas. We'll be right back.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization, Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 80% of the referral check to Ave Maria Radio and Students for Life. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile, a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio for over 15 years. Charity Mobile is the pro-life cell phone company and has sent nearly $2 million to thousands of pro-life charities. 4G LTE coverage is available nationwide, and 5% of your monthly plan price goes to your favorite pro-life charity. A video introduction is available at charitymobile.com. Charity Mobile, everyday living, effortless giving. CharityMobile.com.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA. Or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Hi there, I'm Dr. Greg Popchak.
And I'm Lisa Popchak.
Research shows that when families openly live and share their faith together, they're more able to respond positively to the challenges they face every day.
So if you're looking for help in creating that joyful place where each member of your family experiences life as a gift from God, then you will want to check out our book, Discovering God Together, The Catholic Guide for Raising Faithful Kids.
You can find this book on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net.
Get more information on today's guest and download the program from the Ave Maria Radio website, AveMariaRadio.net. And when your local radio signal is out of reach, listen live on the Ave Maria Radio app.
He recently filed a federal civil rights lawsuit against Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf and the Secretary for the Pennsylvania Department of Health, challenging, among other things, the state's Orwellian contact tracing program. Under this program, Big Brother is alive and well in Pennsylvania. Indeed, the contact tracing program grants the government extraordinary power to impose draconian restrictions, including a 14-day quarantine, which is the equivalent of a house arrest. The restrictions are enforced through fines and criminal penalties, and there is no procedure for challenging the government's orders. If you or someone who may have had contact with you test positive for COVID-19, an army of contact tracers will hunt you down. Through this program, the government uses its authority to inquire into and search out the private associations of individuals and their children, tracing where they have been and who they were with. The breadth of government power under this program forces individuals to keep their children from attending public schools in person, to avoid seeking medical treatment, and to avoid businesses, restaurants, and other public or social events that may keep rosters, lists, video, or other ways to document persons who entered the business establishment or attended the event. The program also forces individuals to avoid worship services where pre-registration is required. The power grab by liberal politicians during this current pandemic is devastating to freedom. I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel for the American Freedom Law Center, bringing you this Faith and Freedom Minute.
Support for Ave Maria programming comes in part by CatholicCounselors.com. Self-help resources and support from Catholic telecounselors from the privacy of home. CatholicCounselors.com, helping your faith, life, and relationships flourish.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. With me is Dr. Jerry Wegemer. He's professor of English at the University of Dallas, where he directs the Center for Thomas More Studies. He is co-editor, along with Stephen Smith, of the Essential Works of Thomas More, and it's an outstanding volume published by Yale University Press. You can learn more at essentialmore.org, essentialmore.org. We'll have that linked at our site as well. Jerry, I keep coming back to this, been running through my mind throughout the interview, and that is, given Thomas More's outstanding commitment to self-government, and Chesterton calls him a champion of liberty, how is it that he is, I think, ignored by the founding fathers of the United States?
I wouldn't say ignored by the founding fathers. In fact, the utopia is referred to in the Federalist Papers by Hamilton.
Okay.
And More's utopia is a case study, very provocative, meant to be, that forces you to think about what elements would be involved in actually, truly, a people ruling themselves. He's dealing with all the issues that our founding fathers actually grappled with. Utopia, for instance, when More speaks in his own character, he's sometimes quoting word for word Cicero, and Cicero is a key character that every American founder would have known.
Right.
And More is also introducing Cicero's whole vocabulary of self-government in the Latin version of his literary works. This is both in Richard III, it's in his Latin poetry, it's in his Utopia. So, of course, this is cultural dynamite. More was a man early on who writes that he has a special hatred for tyranny. He has a special love for the people. One other element that we've included in this volume are all the earliest biographies, biographical accounts of More. And one of the most surprising and revealing is a play written by five London playwrights, including Shakespeare, called Sir Thomas More. And that play presents More as the best friend the poor ever had.
Really?
And it celebrates him. It's a completely positive play, and that's why it doesn't get past Queen Elizabeth's censors, in which More is on the side of the whole city. The mayor says how proud they are to have More as a citizen. You see More's home where he has members of every element of the society there. More was known as a leading citizen. And this is the term that he uses in his poetry and in Utopia. The head of every city of Utopia is called a princeps, or a leading citizen. And this is a concept that Cicero develops in his, especially his later writings, that the role of a leader is to look to the good of the whole city and not one part. So if that's your ideal, that laws are just to bring about justice for everyone, not for a privileged class, not for, and again, this is going to be one of the reasons that so many people leave Europe to come to America, where you can actually have a chance, not based on inheritance, but based on merit and your own work, and also that you'd have a voice in government. The other element that is crucial here for More is education.
Yes.
And we have to talk a little bit about that, because
sure.
He's one of the most famous ones in the history of education. His daughters were among the most educated in Europe. He had to hire tutors from Oxford and abroad so that his daughters could have the same education he had in Oxford, because an educated citizenry is necessary for a self-governing people, women and men.
Yeah.
And Moore saw that clearly.
The more we talk, he becomes a champion of liberty, champion of self-government, a champion of lifelong education, and again, for women as well. His daughters are respected. He's a man of cheer and humor. He's a great modern saint, and he deals with suffering. So he doesn't ignore it like so many modern heroes. Do you expect that we're going to see a renewal, a revival, or a new appreciation of Thomas Moore in the future, near future?
For sure. In fact, we are. There has been an explosion of scholarship in the last 20 years about Moore. And this is just bringing to the fore Chesterton's surprising prediction in 1929 that Moore, he said in 1929, Moore is more important at this moment than any moment since his death, even perhaps the moment of his dying, but he's not quite so important as he will be in about 100 years' time.
Wow. That's great. Yeah,
2029 is not far off.
That's right. That's right. Wow.
And 2035 will be the 500th anniversary of his martyrdom. Hmm. St. John Paul II was a statesman himself. He was a student of history and philosophy, and his seeing Moore's importance as precisely the type of person that has a life of integrity. He points out his integrity. He points out him as a hero of conscience. He points him out, he quotes Cicero, that by obeying the laws we shall be free. He sees in Moore the type of human being that is needed, educated, professional, civically aware and involved. And in that way, he does give a very full example of the elements one would need to develop early on in order to be the captain of a ship, especially a ship that faces many storms.
That's right, right. Let me ask you about some comparisons. St. Thomas More is St. Thomas More. His friend Erasmus is contemporary, also brilliant. What's the difference between the two men?
Their similarity is their commitment to a vibrant renewal of Christianity and the classical tradition. And Erasmus, at Moore's encouragement and the encouragement of Moore's circle of friends when Erasmus visits, I believe, six times England. And he himself then masters Greek. He goes on to be the editor of a Greek version of the New Testament. He does many commentaries. He edits most of the church fathers so that they're accessible.
Mm-hmm.
And so they share fully this educational vision of a true Christianity rooted in love of the person and knowledge of Christ, but also one fully educated in terms of the secular professions of life.
Okay. So they have an understanding that the lordship of Christ extends beyond a clerical vocation, but that affects all areas of a man, woman's life.
That's correct. In fact, in these early biographies, the first biography that's in the collection and is actually done is by Erasmus. And Erasmus presents Moore as a model for his own time.
Interesting.
A person who does integrate all of the dimensions, family, friends, professional, civic, spiritual, in a way that is ordered towards justice under God.
Let me ask you about another figure, although this is well over 100 years removed, and that is John Milton, who's also looked upon in the English literary tradition as a champion of free speech, free press. How does he? How does his thinking compare to that of Moore, who wrote at least 130 years before?
That would be a study in itself.
Okay.
And Moore tries to prevent civil war.
Mm-hmm.
He experiences it himself as a young man. He knows the dangers throughout his life. And rather than cause a civil war, which he could have done as the most popular leader of London,
mm-hmm.
he took a very different path than Milton. Milton, as you know, was the secretary for his Cromwell. He defended the execution of the king. He fought on the side of the Civil War and had a very different view of what Christianity meant.
Right, right.
So that's a study yet to be done.
Okay.
It would be extraordinarily fruitful. Yeah. But Moore, looking 100 years ahead, knowing the problems of basically a warrior society, because Henry and the nobles of England at that time and for some generations, their ideal was the warrior king.
Gotcha.
Moore realized that peace should be the... he did believe in peace among Christian nations. He writes that it's a scandal that Christian princes are fighting against Christian princes. And he also points out that a strength in Parliament and a king with less power is the way to go. And that's generally not appreciated. He saw the same dangers of other writers. He sees the same. He, for instance, reads the same books as Machiavelli, as Hobbes, as Locke. But he comes up with it. He honors the importance of private property. He defends private property. But he has a balance in terms of the institutions that would be needed for a true self-governing people and for a justice that's going to do well for all. It's why I think it's very significant that in this play by five London playwrights, written at a time when they themselves fear civil war. Mm-hmm. Elizabeth is on her deathbed. She's made no provision for the next successor. Everyone's thinking about bloodshed in England again. And what do the five London playwrights come up with? A man of true justice, thinking about the whole city, who can use humor and the law to protect everyone.
We've only got about a minute left, and I realize I failed to ask a question that I'm sure some people are asking themselves. His wife, tell me about his marriage to his wife and what it was like.
Erasmus admires how well they get along, although they're of different temperaments.
Mm-hmm.
And she does not understand, Alice does not understand Moore's decision at the end. She strongly opposes it. It does not make sense to her. And that's also part of the drama of the life that's very instructive. It's probably the hardest, for sure, it was the hardest part of his final decisions. He says it keeps him awake at night. He keeps thinking about what's going to happen to his family. Sometimes duty requires some supreme sacrifice.
Jerry, thank you so much for being with me today, but for this remarkable accomplishment of the last 30 years, the essential works of Thomas Moore. I hope it gets all the attention it deserves, and I look forward to talking to you again in the future. Thanks.
Wonderful. Thank you, Al.
Professor Jerry Wegemer and Stephen W. Smith have given us The Essential Works of Thomas Moore, published by Yale University Press. It's huge, and it's so robust in its presentation of Thomas Moore that I think for a long time this is going to be the, this is the touchstone. If you want to know about Thomas Moore in a full way, it contains all 20 of his books, 106 of his letters, 300 of his poems. They reconstruct the trial, illustrations of art related to him, prayers, spiritual guidebooks, dialogues that he wrote. And we actually, in our conversation today, only scratched the surface of this remarkable man's life. I'm Al Cresta.
This Ave Maria program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit CMF Curo. If you're facing uncertainty with your current healthcare plan, now is the time to join CMF Curo. You can join any time during the year, and CMF Curo offers flexible Catholic healthcare solutions for individuals, families, and employers. CMF Curo is your personal healthcare advocate. Contact them today at mycatholichealthcare.com. That's mycatholichealthcare.com.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta. Americans are voting. The two major parties represent very different ways of protecting religious liberty, the preborn, and selecting the judges who should interpret our laws. Much is at stake. Many years ago, I read a book called Shaping History Through Prayer and Fasting, and I learned that our chief opponents on earth are not human beings, but principalities and powers in the heavenly places. Naturally, our weapons of war must include prayer and fasting. Imagine it. God has granted American believers the dignity and opportunity of changing American history through supernatural means. So don't neglect the tools he's given us, and don't let the perfect become the enemy of the good. If you can't pray and fast every day, do so when you can. St. Catherine of Siena said, God can't use what we won't give him, but he won't despise even our humblest effort. So go out, pray, and vote.
There's a lot of uncertainty in the world right now. Companies have temporarily stopped hiring. Sporting events are held without fans. Even your friends are being told to keep their social distance from you. However, at Ave Maria University, we ask you to consider advancing while the world around you recedes. Gaining an online master's degree in business administration or theology can propel you forward, distinguishing you from the competition when companies again start hiring. Apply now at avemaria.edu.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta, thanking you for being with me and reminding you that the books we talked about today are available in the online bookstore. Again, the essential works of Thomas More and also Heroes and Heretics of the Reformations by Phil Campbell, all those available there. We also have follow-up information on the horrific terrorist attack in Nice, France. I mentioned earlier Cardinal Seurat says the West must wake up to the threat of Islamism. And we've said this for years. In America, we have a very even infantile understanding of Islam. And we tend to rely on old comforting cliches rather than actually say, what do they believe and why? And that's where we have to begin the conversation. Catholic Answers Live coming up, and Lord willing, I'll be back tomorrow for another edition of this thing we call Cresta in the Afternoon. I'll see you then.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.